Quick warning, this episode contains mention of sexual assault. The new film, Where the Crawdads Sing, tells the story of a mysterious death in the marshes of 1960s North Carolina. It's a tale of isolation, abuse, and resiliency based on Delia Owens' best-selling 2018 novel. I'm Stephen Thompson, and today we are talking about Where the Crawdads Sing on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining me today is NPR senior editor Barry Hardiman. Hi, Barry.
Hi.
So glad to have you here. Also joining us is Greta Johnson, host of the Nerdette podcast from WBEZ. Hi, Greta.
Hey, Stephen. Hey, Barry. I'm super excited to be here.
Yay.
I'll talk about anything with y'all.
Well, we're going to talk about this. So Delia Owens' novel, Where the Crawdads Sing, is a blockbuster bestseller. It has sold more than 10 million copies, thanks in part to its selection for Reese Witherspoon's book club. Now Witherspoon is an executive producer on this movie adaptation. The film stars Daisy Edgar Jones as Kaya, who was abandoned in the marshes of North Carolina as a child and raised herself into adulthood. She's an outcast in the nearby town of Barkley Cove, where most of the residents refer to her as Marsh Girl. But Kaya attracts the interest of two different young men. Tate, played by Taylor John Smith, teaches Kaya how to read and write before heading off to college. Chase, played by Harris Dickinson, also courts her, but he turns up dead in the marsh, leading Kaya to be charged with murder. The story that unfolds is part mystery, part courtroom drama, part love triangle, and part nature film. Along the way, we meet Kaya's lawyer, played by David Strathairn, and the town's helpful black shopkeepers, played by Michael Hyatt and Sterling Macer Jr. The film is directed by Olivia Newman, and the screenplay was adapted by Lucy Alibar, who co-wrote the screenplay for Beasts of the Southern Wild. Greta, I'm going to start with you. What is your relationship with this story, and what did you think of the movie?
Okay, so I actually never read this book, partly because sometimes Reese's book picks, as you mentioned, it was a Reese Witherspoon book club pick, and like sometimes they're a bit like twee isn't quite the right word, but like not quite for me, I guess is what I will say. So I hadn't read this book, so I went in knowing pretty much nothing about it. I will say, making things is really hard, and I want to give a lot of credit to anyone who makes a thing. I thought the setting was gorgeous, but beyond that, the phrase I found myself using a lot when I thought about this movie was fell flat. The characters didn't really do a lot for me, and the story didn't really do a lot for me. I mean, Barry, I assume you read the book. I'm curious like how it worked as an adaptation.
I mean, in that I did not like the book or the movie, it worked.
Okay, well, great. That's okay. We'll call that a win.
But I think there are many, many better books to read if the setting interests you, if the topic of person raising themselves despite terrible parents and abandonment interests you, if
relationship to nature, I think, is a beautiful theme that you can find.
Sure. I am interested that this book took off so much. And I think in some ways it's due to its real, there's a real sort of deus ex machina situation at the end, which we should not give away. That plot point is also in the movie. It's kind of one of those things where you're very surprised enough to think that you're being moved by it may be a good thing. Do you know what I mean? Like sometimes just the like, oh, that was surprising. And again, as I will echo, and in fact, I may say this to my children at some point, which is making things is hard. Mm. And the book I found very just stereotypes of the time of the only black characters are like just this real, just blatant stereotyping of the magical black couple, you know, and all of these ways. And that also is translated to the screen. So for me, it doesn't work in any form.
Huh. I think I liked this film like one letter grade more than you guys did, which is not a massive leap, but it is a step. I found it to be kind of a very familiar echo of those kind of like 90s Grisham, like kind of humid Southern legal movies, and found it fairly engrossing as such. I definitely got echoes of Beasts of the Southern Wild, which was a movie I liked, but I was surprised going into it, knowing what a blockbuster story this is, knowing how much people have attached to this story. I was surprised at how familiar the beats felt and how much it felt like it was being cobbled together from other parts. And so to me, this was a you stream it on Netflix at 2 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, and it's fine.
Yeah.
And like, it tapped into a little bit of nostalgia that I felt for those Grisham adaptations that were huge in the 90s. And so to me, I kind of came out of this film like, that was fine.
Yeah. Mm.
But as I thought about it more, one of the things that really kind of stuck with me ties into a lot of people's feelings about Delia Owens, who mm-hmm. wrote the book. And if you look at Delia Owens' life, she has had a fascinating life. She's currently in her early 70s. This was her debut novel, and it was this massive, massive sensation. If you look at her life, she was a wildlife conservationist in Africa for decades. She was caught up in controversies involving the killing of a poacher in the 90s. She co-wrote several memoirs with her now ex-husband, but she has spent her entire life in a way like observing other people's existences from a distance, mm-hmm. if that makes mm-hmm. sense. Mm-hmm. She and her husband came into Africa and had this very contentious relationship with a lot of the people who lived in Africa. And this story is documenting someone else's existence in a way that doesn't feel lived in. It doesn't necessarily feel like it's embodying this person's existence. And so I found the central character, who was living a fascinating life, I found her completely unknowable. Mm-hmm. She feels like a device, if that makes sense. Did you guys feel like that?
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, we've talked about it as a murder mystery, which it arguably is, but I think it's also an outsider story, right? They call her Marsh Girl. She can't fit in. The one time she tries to go to school, they make fun of her. Yes, things are hard for her as a character, right? She's abandoned as a child. She doesn't know how to read or write. But I don't know. I felt like the storyline of sort of the outlier trying to be accepted by the town, or the people of the town trying to learn how to embrace this person who they've always disliked, felt really unearned to me. Like, it just didn't really work. You know, there's this big speech towards the end where the lawyer is essentially like, you have let this girl down. And it's supposed to be kind of this big moment where, you know, everyone's hearts finally warm up to this person. And it just, I just didn't really think it worked, especially given the fact that here she is. She's gorgeous, right? She's a white woman. She wears these like adorable, super feminine, lacy, flowery outfits.
Oh my God. Was there an anthropology like, in the marsh?
Was there remarkable orthodontist work being done in the marsh?
Right. Remarkable.
It's like, what is not to like about this person?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, like, it's not like she didn't have her struggles, but let's tally up all the privileges this person still has too, you know? And then like, is it really that hard? Like, I don't know. I don't know.
Well, this was taking place in 1960s North Carolina. And there's a moment where the two black characters, Jumpin' and Mabel, they sort of are her only friends and maybe parental figures.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of become caretakers.
Yes.
You know, they're the ones like, do you need shoes?
Yes,
do you have enough
exactly.
food?
And
you know?
There's one moment where Jumpin', you know, threatens to report like a sexual assault to the police. Can you imagine in 1960s North Carolina, a black man have any faith in fair treatment?
Having any faith, yeah.
And so many pieces of this world don't hang together in a way that even people that don't live in it would understand this. Whether it be in novel or in film, it's hard to take.
Did y'all also, I mean, narratively, I was also frustrated by the fact that there were like all the obstacles were fake.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, think about the going to school thing. She gets made fun of once. She can't go back.
Mm.
You know, even like there's this whole thing where the land she lives on could be hers, but she has to pay all this back taxes. And like, she figures out how to make the money. You know, like it just felt like there were all of these things that like, as a viewer, I kept thinking like, oh, here, this is going to be the thing.
Right.
And none of them ended up being the thing. And then 2 hours later, I was just sort of like, oh, I guess that's it.
You were like, oh, that's a really nice furnished house. When they were bringing that couch into the house, you know, which is funny, like all of this stuff, you know, does happen in one way or another in the book, but somehow seeing it made it more ridiculous to me than, you know, because I was just like, oh, they really deliver pretty far out, you know? But yeah, I think that you're absolutely right. That sort of lack of real narrative barrier is a hard one.
And I don't know. I wonder if that's partly what people tend to like so much about the book, too, is that I guess you could argue that it all goes down pretty easy, which, you know, I totally get appreciating material these days that you don't have to, like, struggle with, you know? I just feel like this one falls short.
This one felt like The Help to me more than any other book that I've read in a long time.
There are definitely echoes of it for sure.
Yeah.
What did you guys think of the performances in this film? I mean, this film is really built around Daisy Edgar Jones's performance as Kaya. And that's a very, very, very tricky ask, in part because this character is a combination of so many literary devices. I mean, she has to convey a deep intelligence and a deep resourcefulness without necessarily having had the socialization that most other people have had. Do you think, does she pull it off at all, given the limitations of this material?
I thought she was very good. She's very watchable on screen, and I don't just mean attractive.
I mean, she's in Normal People. She's been in a lot of big stuff.
Yeah, which I loved Normal People, by the way. And I think this is an extraordinarily good actress. And, you know, she really did carry this film. You know, when she was on screen by herself, like, futzing with things in the marshlands, I was more compelled than any other time. And so, like, I think her sort of natural charisma does a lot for this movie. And if there are limitations, as you say, I think it is in the material. But I think she's, you know, this should not stop her from being cast in better adaptations.
I wish her love of nature were conveyed, like, more eloquently. Like, there are moments where we're supposed to pick up on that. And a lot of them are with this dude as their romance develops. And they felt a bit trite to me. It would have been fun to figure out some other ways to really explore that. But in the end, I actually did think her relationship with Tate, who's like the nice boy who teaches her how to read, is probably the most believable relationship she has with anyone. You know, like, I didn't really end up caring a lot about her mom. Mm-hmm. I didn't really end up caring a lot about her brother. Mm-hmm. But the two of them and their dynamic and, you know, how that unravels, I think was probably the best part of the movie to me. I thought most of the other relationships didn't really work, but that one was like, it was nice. And they were both so nice to look at too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, okay, great.
Yeah, no, and they had chemistry. Like, I wanted to see them roll around on a beach.
Yeah, totally. That's hot.
I mean, you got these cool, incredible, perfect straight white teeth.
Right, yeah, yeah. Let's go.
Let's
might as well do some kissing. What did you guys think of the Taylor Swift song? Any thoughts on Taylor rolling over the closing credits? Is anything other than kind of a, let's see if we can get Taylor Swift that Oscar she didn't win for Cats?
Right.
Yeah, I don't think I have anything to add about the Taylor Swift song.
So this is such a hard one for me because I really like Taylor Swift. I really do often in the summertime want to listen to Folklore and Evermore together on repeat.
And this song is very much in the vein of those records.
It's lovely. And so I do think it was maybe just imprudent for her to associate herself with this movie, even though, and I know we're going down several steps to get to the Delia Owens, the, you know, the unsolved case in Africa, given that she, you know, had that just incredibly ill-advised treatment of Wildest Dreams, which was this beautiful white couple in Africa, and many, many beautiful animals and whatever. And just literally, it was, here is Africa peopled only by white people. It immediately sort of like rang that bell for me, which I wish it hadn't, because I do like her. And I loved Miss Americana. And I, you know, I think she is growing into kind of a really interesting songwriter in person and all these things. And I just felt like this one, like, you could get your Oscar for so many other things. I could tell you a million books like this that are coming up that could be atmospheric.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's close with that. Give us a few recommendations for books that people should read. Mm. If they read Where the Crawdads Sing and didn't like it, give us a couple of book picks. You're a book expert. You read.
The first thing I would say is that if you're interested in this, like, raised by yourself kind of thing, I would go back and read the Michael Finkel. It was first an article called The Stranger in the Woods about the hermit who sort of vanished and lived in the Maine woods for 27 years. And you could read the article and be good. The book is also lovely. So yeah, so that's Stranger in the Woods by Michael Finkel. If what interests you is the, boy, we were failed by our parents piece of it, I would say, well, you should go ahead and read everything by Jessamyn Ward. Mm-hmm. Her first novel, which is called Where the Line Bleeds, has a similar setting, and it's about these twin boys and how they sort of struggle to take care of themselves. And it's really beautifully written. If you like that evocative description of place, this definitely has it. And again, I think it's just a much more worthy book. So that's Where the Line Bleeds by Jessamyn Ward. And, you know, this is going to seem like kind of a weird one, but another great book about this sort of thing is All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. Hmm. You know, much awarded book.
Yeah, won the Pulitzer.
Won the Pulitzer. I was going to say that, and then I was like, I couldn't remember if it did or not. Thank you, Greta.
Here for you, babe.
and it has a lot of these same sort of elements, but in Europe. So I guess the thing I would say to people is, there are propulsive books that can get you the thriller aspect, that can get you the fending for yourself aspect, that can get you the setting. And you can do it, I think, with a little bit of better writing. You won't get that crazy twist at the end in all cases. But, you know, if you can live without that, then, you know, go out there and read some Jessamyn Ward.
All right.
Can I have one too?
Yes.
The one that immediately comes to mind for me is called Damnation Spring. It's by Ash Davidson. Did you read this, Barry?
No.
It didn't get enough love as it should have, I think. In a lot of ways, it's very different, but I do think it speaks really beautifully to people's relationship with nature. So this one takes place in the late 70s in the Pacific Northwest in a logging community. And, you know, one of the main characters is this like third generation logger. I'm pretty sure both his father and grandfather died while cutting down redwoods. It's also in the very beginning of the environmental movement. So a big piece of this is there's pesticides in the water, and it's making weird things happen, especially to pregnant women in this town. So it's a really fascinating kind of contradiction around what happens when for generations you have relied on the nature of this place, but also that livelihood is destroying the place and your livelihood. And it's beautiful. It's sweeping. There are a lot of really fascinating characters. It's hefty, too, which I think especially this time of year, it would be the perfect book to take with you on vacation or whatever. And that's Damnation Spring, and it's by Ash Davidson.
Great. Thank you so much. Well, we want to know what you think about Where the Crawdads Sing, about the book, about the movie, about other books that people should read. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. Up next, what is making us happy this week?
This message comes from NPR sponsor Smartwool. Smartwool's new lightweight and breathable activewear is here to help keep you cool and comfortable on even the hottest days. With naturally performing merino wool that beats the heat, the sweat, and the stink during every activity under the sun. So no matter how much you push, persist, or play, get out there with naturally breathable activewear and enjoy 15% off your first purchase when you sign up for Smartwool's mailing list.
Now it's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Greta Johnson, what's making you happy this week?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so if you have spoken with me in real life for like probably 5 minutes or less in the past couple months, you've already heard me rave about this show. But it is For All Mankind on Apple TV Plus. We're in the midst of season 3 right now, which means if you haven't seen any of it, you've got like a whole bunch of episodes to catch up on, which is delightful. So, you know, if you don't know anything about it, this is actually an alternate history. The premise from episode 1 is what would have happened if the Soviets had beat the United States to the moon. So fast forward to season 3, now we're in the 90s and there's a race to Mars happening. Also, like, wow, do I not mind living in a completely different version of America right now? Like, that also works pretty well for me. But this show seriously has everything. It's got espionage. There's like scorned lovers and secrets. It's beautifully plotted. The costumes are great. This thing happens every once in a while where 40 minutes into an episode, they'll be like 2 years later because they're like, oh, the next 2 years would actually be pretty boring. So we're just going to skip them for you.
Love it.
The soundtrack is perfect. This is just like such a great show to watch. So that's what's making me happy.
For All Mankind. Thank you, Greta Johnson.
Yep.
Barry Hardiman, what's making you happy this week?
So I recently had a touch of COVID.
Oh.
And when I had it, I was thankfully not very sick. And I was able to quarantine from my husband and my kids in the basement, sadly, which meant I just was down there by myself and I could only watch things that I wanted to watch. So you know what I did, people? I watched 16 hours of The Witcher, and this show is way more terrific than I had been led to believe. But this is so much fun because it is really fairy tales. And there's a follow-up recommendation to this, which I've now read all of the books you could read of The Witcher, which is by a Polish author named Andrzej Sapkowski. So the thing is that the books are so filled with this like deeply Eastern European fairy tale where there's elves, we've seen this before, haven't we? People like, the elves are discriminated against, but I loved it. I mean, not the discrimination, but the plot is fine. You know, like that kind of stuff. It is so filled with tropes in such a deliciously juicy way and you know what else is great, guys? Sorry, I cannot stop. The fight scenes are really beautifully choreographed. It really reminded me of how I felt on the weekends watching Hercules and Xena, if anyone was a person that did the sort of like monster of the week. So it really, it's fun, you guys. Don't overlook it in this world of ours. Like, this is a fun world. Like, you know?
So this is The Witcher?
Yes.
And you can stream it where?
You can stream it and many other companion pieces, The World of The Witcher, on Netflix. You know that little button in the corner? It says The World of The Witcher. You can bet I clicked.
Wow. Okay. So you guys are recommending gigantic cinematic universes, entire mythologies that you have to dig into. I am recommending the smallest possible representation of the world, which is the social media app Be Real. Now, I don't know if you guys have dipped into Be Real. I have not even started my own Be Real account yet, but my partner, Katie, swears by it, and I have been living vicariously through her. Be Real is an app that you use once a day. It gives you a little ping, and you have 2 minutes to take two pictures that it takes simultaneously. One is a selfie, and one is what you're looking at. And the idea, this is not Instagram. You are not staging lavish spectacles of look at me in Ibiza, look at me in Barcelona as I sip a $27 cocktail and look out at the beach. It's just a little slice of your life. And you only get to post once a day. So you got that Wordle thing where you're spending 5 minutes a day on something instead of 5 hours a day on something. Yeah. But it's just like, here's my dumb face. And you only get one crack at it, so you usually look like a doof. And like maybe your cat happens to be sticking his tongue out in a comical way, or maybe it's just the pot of pasta that you're cooking. But there's something very come-as-you-are about it that is very, very sweet and very contained. Mm. So anyway, that's Be Real, B-E-R-E-A-L. It's an app. It is lovely. That is what is making me happy this week. If you want links for what we recommended, plus more recommendations, sign up for our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. That brings us to the end of our show. Barry Hardiman, Greta Johnson, thanks to both of you for being here.
That was so much fun.
This episode was produced by Ramel Wood and Candace Lim and edited by Jessica Reedy. Hello Come In provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Stephen Thompson, and we will see you all next week.